So, over the next few days, we'll be taking a look at some suttas in the collection known as the Udana, from the Pali Canon, from the Pali Sutta Pitaka, from the Kuddhaka Nikaya, the miscellaneous collection. The Dhammapada is in that miscellaneous collection, as is the Sutta Nipata. But we're looking at the Udana. And we're doing this. And we're using this material in order to understand more fully the nature of going for refuge. And these talks that I'm doing are going to be the basis for the study groups later in the day. I mean, take your Udana text along, because I don't know how the study group leader is going to do it. He might just read through, he might get you to read through the text, and my talks will sort of serve as a background to the material. So that's up to the study group leaders how they do it. And as I say, the purpose of the talks and the groups is to stimulate our understanding and practice of going for refuge more fully and more completely. That's really the attitude that we need to have to this material. And I should just say that this material that we'll be looking at is really very pure. It's been very striking the last few days contemplating this material. I'm just so struck by its purity. The Buddhist ideal is presented in a very pure and uncompromising way. What you have in the Udana are many short suttas which show the Buddha and the early Sangha. And we see people, we see individuals really living the Dharma without compromise and without distraction. And we're going to allow ourselves to measure up against such purity, such idealism and such commitment. And I've chosen to use the Udana on this retreat for two reasons. Partly just because I like it. You know, in a way there's no reason. It's just such a fantastic text that I've been aware of for a long time. It was one of the first Buddhist texts I ever studied with an order member who'd studied with Bhante back in 74, 75. So it's had a big impact on me. So I just like it. But also because I think a text like this can give us a vivid picture of the Buddha. The Buddha, of course, is the founder, the originator of our tradition. He is our teacher. He's the original teacher, if you like. He's our guide. And of course, he's our spiritual ideal. And if we're to go for refuge to the Buddha, we need to understand who he really is. Not just theoretically either. We need, as Bhante has said, to imagine the Buddha, even to reimagine the Buddha. There's that paper, isn't there? Reimagining the Buddha. Well, you know, to do that, you really have to contemplate the old original texts. We need somehow to bring the Buddha vividly to life, here and now, for us, here and now. And we need to fully appreciate the profundity and the sublimity of his attainment in life. And a text like the Udana, I think, can help us do that. And the second reason for choosing the Udana is because it's an important text for Bhante, for Sangharakshita. I'll just use the name Bhante. And it's been an important text for him, and important in the history of our own order and movement. Bhante led two seminars on the Udana, one in 1974, you might be interested to know, under canvas in Cornwall. Bhante was in retreat on a sort of holiday chalet above a cliff face, I think, somewhere in Cornwall, and all the order members, that weren't many in those days, went down and camped nearby, and Bhante would walk over every day and lead study on this text. So, you know, Buddhafield isn't that new. Bhante was doing it long ago. What was interesting about that, there's a nice little story, one of these lovely little myths that you get about the early days. And when Bhante would, it was a mixed seminar, men and women, when Bhante would leave, and by the way, just evoke a bit Sangharakshita for you in those days, A friend of mine showed me photos, old black and white photos of Banti on this seminar. Just check out the dress. Long hair, really long, sort of greasy hair, very sort of bent glasses, unshaven, a sort of tweedy jacket, jeans and bumpers. You know those old, you know, black and white basketball boots that we used to call bumpers. Do you remember those? Interesting choice of gear. Very different from these days. But anyway, apparently when Banti would leave every evening after the study, I think it was in the summertime, an owl would appear on a branch and just watch them. And of course, the order members, they were young, thought, is it Banti? Kind of keeping an eye on us. Anyway, there you are. And he did another seminar in 1975, a year later. Quite a lot of the seminar in 74 was lost, so he did another one in 75. And Banti has a very particular reading of the Udana. He sees the Udana as communicating really the very early days of the Buddha and his Sangha. He reads it in parts as if it's describing the emergence, the forming, the creation of something completely new. After all, you've got a new kind of being that's appeared. An enlightened being, totally unprecedented being, communicating something unique, never been communicated before, the Dhamma, reality, enlightenment. And out of that, creating a completely different kind of community, spiritual community. And of course, these seminars were given, you know, in the earliest days of the movement. The movement wasn't even 10 years old at that time. And it's clear that Banti is seeing sort of resonances, parallels between the earliest days of Buddhism, well, to call it Buddhism, because it wasn't called Buddhism with the Buddha and his early disciples. In a way, it didn't really have a name. Well, you could just say it was the Dharma. So he's seeing resonances between the very earliest days of the Dharma and his own pioneering days of creating the Sangha in the modern world. And one thing he looks at, which we'll look at too, very briefly actually, is some of the language employed. Sometimes in the suttas, you find in the suttas of the Udana, you find old, kind of untechnical, more concrete, more poetic language. Sometimes the later commentators don't know what to make of the language. Don't really, you know, they do an interpretation of it, which they've kind of made up. The language is much more sort of direct, if you like. At the same time, it's rather elusive. Different language coming through. And Banti reads this as showing, he feels what's going on there is that the Buddha is trying to find words to communicate this vision, this taste, this knowledge, this experience that's never been known before. I think in the first seminar he said, well, he's got two choices. He either invents a new language, which nobody understands, or he kind of pushes the existing language to try and communicate this vision. We'll see a bit of that with a particular word towards the end today. In other words, Banti says, we get a glimpse of archaic Buddhism, or here's a nice phrase, or pre-Buddhistic Buddhism. Buddhism without the whole development of analysis and scholarship. You get glimpses, only glimpses, because of course the Udana, like all of the Pali Canon, comes through the filter of a very highly developed Buddhist technical language. So, you know, you just get these glimpses into something older and more ancient, less formed, very alive, very creative. Which the earliest, very earliest days of the Buddha and his disciples would have been in touch with. And we gain these glimpses particularly in the Udanas themselves. If you've looked through the text, you will have noticed that the Udana is made up of many short suttas. And these suttas depict the Buddha sometimes alone, sometimes with others, sometimes looking on at a particular event, a particular happening. And at the end of the sutta, there is a stock phrase. Then, On realizing its significance, the Lord uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance. And then you get the inspired utterance. Inspired utterance is John Ireland's translation. That's this is the translation that I've recommended you get. John Ireland's translation of the word Udana, which is, of course, the name that's been given to the whole collection. Because the Pali in the Udana is much older, archaic, some scholars believe that the verses, the Udanas themselves, represent a much older strand of Dharma than the prose portions. And Udana literally means the upward going breath. And I don't mean by that the out breath, it's the upward moving breath. So we're talking about breath in a figurative, a metaphorical sense, a very different kind of breath, which is much more like an upsurging of inspiration that bursts forth in verse, in poetry. In fact, the Pali itself makes this very clear, because the words used for uttered and inspired utterance are Udanam Udanesi, Udanam Udanesi, which could be literally translated as breathing forth a breathing forth. Breathing forth a breathing forth. The words and the inspiration they come from are fused, are one. So Bhante describes an Udana in these words. The upward going breath, the Udana, is the breath which comes up in a tremendous wave, when you feel very strongly and powerfully moved emotionally, when something is really positively stirred up and you breathe forth an utterance comes up and out under the tremendous stress of this feeling of inspiration and possession almost. So the Udanas are those verses which the Buddha breathed out under the force of tremendous inspiration, either in certain situations with his disciples or spontaneously on his own at some very important or critical stage of his spiritual career. Another bit of Bhante: the Udanas represent the Buddha's utterance at certain crucial moments when he was very deeply moved, spiritually stirred, and he spoke rhythmically in verse. And perhaps we're not used to thinking of the Buddha communicating in this way, in the way Bhante describes it. We're used to, of course, the Buddha giving detailed, progressive, even quite analytical discourses as he moves and is through describing very methodically the stages of the path. And of course, the Buddha did communicate the Dharma in that way, and that's very important. But the Udanas draw attention to a different dimension of the Buddha. It's more like drawing out the Buddha as the inspired sage, so to speak. That's an understatement. The inspired sage, who's utterly free, unfettered, inspired, and in a way spontaneous. And we'll consider that a bit more as we look into the first three suttas in the Udana. We're going to bring that out. So I'm going to take the first three suttas collectively, probably concentrating more on the third. The first three suttas in the Udana are the first of 10 suttas that make up the section called the Bodhi tree. Although in a Pali text we have, the section is called simply Bodhi. It's not called the Bodhi tree, it's called simply Bodhi, awakening or enlightenment. And the first three suttas are certainly all about the Buddha's awakening, his enlightenment, his Bodhi. So right at the beginning of the collection, and right then at the beginning of this retreat, we're presented with the ideal of enlightenment. We are presented, in other words, with our goal and our refuge, the Buddha refuge, with what we're supposed to be aspiring to and striving for. So that's where the Udana begins. In fact, all of the suttas in the Udana are post-enlightenment. There's nothing to do with the Buddha before his enlightenment. They're all post-enlightenment. And the framework of the first three suttas are exactly the same, but there are some variations in their content. So let's just look closely at the framework and try to tease things out, and our guide to this will of course be Bhante. Actually, I'm going to read the third sutta, I think. Just go through it a bit. Actually, not the third, because it's... anyway, they start in the same way. So, the Bodhi tree. Thus have I heard. So, thus have I heard, of course, the I here is traditionally Ananda. Ananda is said to have remembered all of the suttas, which he then recited at the first council. No need, I think, to dwell on that. That's been well rehearsed. But that's the tradition. It's that the I here is Ananda remembering and reciting what he'd heard. Then you get, at one time, the Lord. So this is a translation of Bhagava. Bhante feels that the Lord doesn't really communicate the real meaning of this term, and he prefers his own translation, which is the richly endowed one, the one endowed with all kinds of qualities. The Buddha is rich in qualities. And when we meditate on the Buddha, when we bring the Buddha to mind, the way into that very often is to dwell on his particular qualities. Enlightenment, of course, isn't abstract. There's no such thing, in a sense, as enlightenment. There are only enlightened beings with particular qualities, wisdom, metta, energy, and so on. So Bhagava, rather than Lord, the richly endowed one, was staying at Aruvala. So Aruvala is modern-day Bodh Gaya, and he's beside the river Niranjara, at the foot of the Bodhi tree, having just realised full enlightenment. The Pali can also be translated as having recently or newly realised full enlightenment, Sambodhi, complete and perfect enlightenment, or complete and perfect awakening. So the first sutta of the Udana, the first three suttas of the Udana, depict the Buddha newly, freshly enlightened. So we just have a few words here, but we have to picture this. We have to visualize this. We have to imagine this. What would the Buddha have looked like, newly, freshly enlightened? And don't just follow the conventions of traditional Eastern Buddhist art. The Buddha, you know, where you get these sort of images of the Buddha all sort of bright and shiny with immaculately pressed yellow robes and sort of pink or gold skin and all the strange details of traditional Buddhist iconography. The Buddha was a summoner, a kind of freelance, wandering ascetic, let's say, Shramana in Sanskrit. Very part of that community of people who'd just gone off wandering, begging to realise the truth. He was a homeless mendicant. He'd one who had gone forth to seek the truth. So he would have been wearing patched, discoloured clothing. He would have taken the ordinary white clothing that people would have worn, we would call it a robe, and he would have discoloured it. Maybe he would have patched it with rags found in the cremation ground. I mean, Arlo could really took hold of this idea with the robes on our rupa. In fact, the whole rupa in part is inspired by Bhante's, by Sangharakshita's evocation of the Buddha in the Udana seminar. It's partly inspired by that. So he would have been sitting there in rag robes. He would have been lean but strong, maybe possibly unshaven. I think there might even be an element of that on this rupa. His hair may have been quite long. And at this stage, there's no community. There's no following. There are no disciples. We're presented with the Buddha alone, the lone individual in the jungle, having just freshly, newly woken up to the way things are. We're not looking at, here at a religious leader. In fact, actually, we should really not think of the Buddha in any way as a religious leader. You sometimes hear, don't you, on the radio or something like that, people talking about the founders of different religions, and the Buddha is included in one of them. Well, that's not what the Buddha was like. The Buddha didn't found a religion. He was an enlightened man who communicated with people and who had disciples. But he was not a religious leader, never set out to be a religious leader. So here he is, alone in the jungle, freshly enlightened. He's just woken up, having just realised the truth. So what does he do? What's happening? So the text says, at that time, the Lord sat cross-legged for 7 days, experiencing the bliss of liberation. At that time, the Lord sat cross-legged for 7 days, experiencing the bliss of liberation. So what's going on here? 7 days seated cross-legged, experiencing the bliss of liberation. I fancy a bit of that, I have to say. And the following two suttas describe things in the same way. Again, you have the Lord was seated cross-legged for 7 days, experiencing the bliss of liberation. In fact, there's a whole number of suttas like this in this collection and in others, which describe the Buddha either sitting beneath the Bodhi tree or some other tree in the vicinity, sitting for 7 days, experiencing the bliss of liberation. I'll come to the bliss of liberation in a moment. But to gain an understanding, as well as a feeling for what these suttas are pointing to, we need to understand the nature of Bodhi, of the Buddha's enlightenment, of his awakening. And the first thing that needs to be said, that we always need to keep in mind, is that enlightenment, the Buddha's enlightenment, is utterly beyond words and conceptions. Utterly beyond words and conceptions. A sutta in another collection shows the Buddha after his enlightenment reflecting, this Dhamma, this reality, this truth is profound, hard to perceive, hard to know, peaceful, transcendent, beyond the sphere of thought, subtle, to be known only by the wise. Very important to dwell on this. The Buddha's enlightenment, the reality he saw and experienced, well, we use the language of saw and experienced, but that is only a manner of speaking. Anyway, that reality is deeply mysterious to us. It's profound and subtle and cannot be known through thought. It's Lokuttara, beyond the world, transcendent. And it's important to dwell on this, I think especially in the modern West, because people, Buddhists, can be so incredibly glib and superficial about enlightenment. You hear people, sometimes you even hear yourself, spouting off about enlightenment, even about their insight, as if they know what the nature of the Buddha's enlightenment really is. But what they know is a set of words and ideas. The Buddha does, of course, attempt to point to his vision of things as they are with words. He does give us ideas so that we can use them to gain liberation. He does so in these three suttas in which we're shown conditioned co-production, Pratitya Samuppada, both its basic principle, as well as its working out in relation to the links of the Nidana chain. But the Buddha's actual vision, his Bodhi, his awakening, his enlightenment, is beyond all words. And in the seminar, Bhante tries to communicate what it might have been like by saying that these suttas in which the Buddha is depicted as sitting cross-legged for 7 days, he thinks that it's really describing the Buddha's long period of absorption after enlightenment. Something extraordinary has happened. And these, by the way, this 7 days, seven is a magic number in ancient Indian tradition. It's really pointing to something timeless. It's not really about seven exact days or multiples of seven. The Buddha is dwelling in a timeless zone, a timeless realm. The Buddha has seen things as they really are, directly, without words and concepts and ideas. He has seen and known, and this seeing and knowing is utterly transforming. Utterly transforming. He is a new being. So, of course, there was a long period of absorption, absorbing what had happened. So listen to how Bhante tries to imagine what has gone on. What one can be sure of is that there was a tremendous inner absorption for a very long period of time. After all, the Buddha had gained enlightenment, which he had been looking for so many years. And at last, he was there. So all his energy poured into that, just like a waterfall falling from a tremendous height. Everything goes over. There's nothing left behind. And it's quite conceivable that only after some days that he even started thinking and even started directing his attention to describing the nature of what he had seen. And he saw, the way he described what he saw, was a whole vast process. He saw how an individual comes into existence, how that individual develops, and how it passes away, and he saw how it is bound up with suffering. And he saw it in one great direct flash, as it were, in a very vivid and immediate fashion, of which the actual formulas here give us very little hint, especially if we don't use our imagination. I think we have to try and feel our way back into at least some measure of what it must have been like on that occasion when the Buddha's mind started working again, his higher mind, his intuition. He started looking, and he saw how individual beings come into existence as a result of what they had done in previous lives and how they perpetuated the whole process. So we have the Buddha newly awakened, newly enlightened. He has seen in one direct flash the true nature of existence, and he sits absorbed for a very long period of time, eventually discerning with his higher intuition the principle that best expresses that enlightenment, the principle of conditioned co-production, the principle that life is one vast becoming bound up with ignorance and craving and suffering. And in seeing this, the Buddha is completely and fully liberated. It's interesting as well in the seminar that Bhante also adds that he also thinks there is sort of something missing in the presentation, and that is the conditioned co-production, looking at it in terms of progressive spiral development. And of course you do find later suttas where the Buddha talks about conditioned co-production as the unfolding of the path to enlightenment. So we need to have that in mind as well. So this is all very important, because the Bodhisuttas tell us that not only did the Buddha sit cross-legged for periods of 7 days, he did so experiencing the bliss of liberation. Great phrase, experiencing the bliss of liberation. For a hedonist like me, that's such a relief to read that line. Experiencing the bliss of liberation. The word for experiencing is patisangvedi, which can also mean feeling and enjoying. So he's feeling the bliss of liberation. He's enjoying the bliss of liberation. It's very important, this. You know, we shouldn't have the idea that in enlightenment there's no enjoyment, no pleasure. Although, of course, it's a pleasure and a bliss and an enjoyment which isn't taking place within the subject-object framework like it is for us. So there is the Buddha enjoying the bliss of liberation, the vimuttisukha. Vimuttisukha. The bliss of freedom, the bliss of release, the deep happiness of liberation. So the Buddha's enlightenment, his vision, has this effect. It results in the bliss of liberation. The liberation from all conditioning, all ignorance, all craving, and therefore all suffering. So we need to imagine this. We need to imagine the Buddha's freedom. He's sitting there, alone, in the forest, in the jungle, in his rag robes. Apart from his rag robes and a begging bowl, probably, that's all he's got. He's got nothing else. He's got no home. In a sense, he's got no name or identity. He left all that behind when he went forth. So he's got no family, no community, no tribe, no money, no possessions. He doesn't even have any friends. Those friends deserted him when he took some solid food, remember? And yet here he is, enjoying the bliss of liberation. He doesn't, it seems, experience any limits, any boundaries to his consciousness. That's what liberation is. There's just no boundary to consciousness. Even the notion of consciousness has gone. Even that idea, not that it's a blank space, but consciousness would, you know, it indicates something with a boundary, but there are no boundaries. His vision of Pratityasamutpada, the unfixed becoming nature of all experienced, has dissolved all fetters, all bindings, and there is just this open-ended, blissful freedom. And many people are attracted to the Dharma, to the Buddha, to Buddhism, because of its emphasis on freedom, to the Buddha's emphasis on freedom. People love that saying that the Dharma has the taste of freedom, of liberation, just as the ocean has the taste of salt. People love this. But the liberation and the freedom that the Buddha experienced and taught is very different from some of our own notions of freedom. In the world today, freedom is a very, very confused topic. And I think we really need to look into it. In fact, we need, I think, to do quite a project of bringing the Buddha's wisdom to bear on the topic of freedom. And Bhante did that in that lecture, The Taste of Freedom, which is a very good lecture. It's a big topic, which I can't really explore now. Maybe it can be taken up in the groups. But I do want to make a few comments. And the comments are really to do with the bases of the Buddha's liberation. There are three bases to the Buddha's liberation, from what I can work out. First of all, renunciation. Renunciation. We need to be very clear that the founder of our tradition, the embodiment of our spiritual ideal, left home, left the family, left the Indian extended family, left the group, left the caste, left the tribe, left society. He left behind then all security, all insurance, in fact. He did that so he could search for the truth without compromise, without compromise of any kind. If you like, he gave himself no choice at all. He cut away all choices and fully committed himself to the discovery of reality, which of course meant inhibiting desires by following an ethical code and living especially a completely harmless life. It's very important, I think, to dwell on the Buddha. Sometimes in this way, sometimes I think Buddhists throughout the world have a kind of strange relationship with the Buddha. They kind of love the Buddha and he's there and you see images of him. But there's this kind of unspoken reality about the Buddha's nature of him being a renunciate, which people kind of don't talk about. And it's probably very difficult for most of us, any of us actually, to emulate the Buddha, the Buddha's life. But what we do need to look into is the complexity of our lives, our own lack of simplicity. We need to check how much we've bought into contemporary notions of freedom, which seems these days to mean freedom to consume, to have, to own whatever we want. The latest gadget, for example. Or freedom to choose how we're going to live. You're going to hear people sometimes kind of weighing up, well, I could do this, I could do that. Meanwhile, life is going on and there's absolutely no growth and development at all. Because what is happening is there is the tyranny of choice. The tyranny of choice, which masquerades as freedom. This is one of the big kind of myths, I think, of the modern world, that media people, politicians, marketing people perpetuate choice, freedom of choice, which is actually tyranny, which keeps people in a state of subjection to their desires. Very few people these days, I think, want to really commit themselves to a full-time Dharma life, a full-time spiritual life, and to full-time Dharma work. It's very, very noticeable that people want to keep their options open, using often the language of freedom to justify an unwillingness to really plunge in to the Dharma. So we need to look at the Buddha and to consider deeply why he renounced home and family, why he burnt all his bridges in his search for the truth, because it is the first basis for the Buddha's freedom. So then the second basis of the Buddha's freedom is his constant and continuous work on freeing the mind of restricting mental and emotional states. In various places in the pre-enlightenment life of the Buddha, you see the Buddha purifying his mind of greed, of aversion, of fear, of conceit, and so on. And he's doing this, of course, in meditation. It's what we do in meditation. There's a wonderful passage describing the Buddha's work in meditation just before his enlightenment. It's not in the Udana, it's in other suttas. I forget the sutta it's in now. But he moves through the dhyanas, never allowing himself to be trapped, even in a sort of state of meditative attainment. He's constantly freeing himself into a more and more expanded consciousness. So meditation is not about sitting and spacing out. Real meditation is about identifying in ourselves what William Blake called the mind-forged manacles. The mental states, the emotions, the views, the opinions, the ideas that bind us, that restrict us, that are restriction itself. And I think particularly important if we're going to have the meditative basis for liberation are the Brahma-viharas, the divine, the sublime abidings of metta, karuna, mudita and upeksha. And Bhante also adds to that faith, reverence, devotion. And these are known collectively as chetto-vimutti, the liberation of the heart, because in these emotions, in these states in meditation, these divine abidings, well, they're more than emotions, they're Brahma-viharas, we dissolve all boundaries. They're also known as apamanyas, the boundless states, because self and other are dissolved in these states. And of course, they're ecstatic and blissful. So that's the second basis of freedom, the meditative basis. The first basis, which is simplifying our life, moving away from complexity, going forth as much as we can. The second basis is meditation. And of course, the third basis for the Buddha's freedom is wisdom. Seeing things as they really are, seeing into the very roots of the fetters themselves. And in these first three suttas of the Udana, we see the Buddha identifying what we need to meditate upon in order to develop the wisdom that leads to the bliss of liberation. In identifying conditioned co-production as the principle that best expresses his vision, the Buddha is providing us with the means to develop the wisdom that leads to the bliss of liberation. An indestructible bliss of liberation. And of course, we could spend a lot of time looking at conditioned co-production, but we're not going to. Just to remind you to come on the Transcendental Principle Retreat that we run at least once a year, where we give that a good looking into. But I do just want to mention the Buddha's insight into the principle expressed in the third sutta, because this is just so classic. This being, that becomes, from the arising of this, that arises, this not being, that does not become, from the ceasing of this, that ceases. And the text says that the Buddha gave this well-reasoned attention. Other translations have close attention. And I'm sure in the case of the Buddha, such attention would have been natural. He would have been naturally seeing that principle that expresses his wordless vision. But he's giving it close attention. Perhaps there's even maybe at the back of his mind, this is what people need to hear. This is what I need to tell. But the text is also putting it like that because it's telling us how to practice. If you want to gain wisdom, if you want to gain insight and the liberation, the bliss of liberation that results from wisdom, give very, very close and concentrated attention to this very simple but very profound essential Dharma verse. Learn it. Learn it by heart. Remember it. Repeat it again and again and again. And above all, see it working in everything you do, in all processes, on all levels, and how it informs everything you do. So if you want the bliss of liberation, simplify your life, cut down choices, commit yourself fully to the path, liberate the mind of restrictive states through meditation, especially metta, and meditate on conditioned co-production. Simples. So we need to end today's talk by looking at the Udana, the actual verse that the Buddha gives. I'm just going to look at the Udana that concludes the third sutta. So John Ireland translates this verse as, when things become manifest to the ardent meditating Brahmin, he abides scattering Mara's hosts like the sun illumining the sky. So what I want to pick up on first of all here is the word Brahmin. Brahmin is of course the name of a caste in India, the caste that still exists. In fact, Brahmins regard themselves as the highest caste. They are, of course, the priestly caste. So what the Buddha is doing in the first 10 suttas of the Udana, it stops after the first 10 suttas, which is interesting. What the Buddha does in the first 10 suttas of the Udana is that he attempts to redefine what it means to be the superior man in society. He tries to redefine the word Brahmin. Brahmin. He's trying to change its definition. Basically saying that a Brahmin, it's not to do with birth. It's not about being born into a particular family and caste. It's about your moral and spiritual quality. And we have to say that the Buddha's attempt to redefine the Brahmin failed. It drops out of most of the discourses in the Pali Canon. The weight, if you like, of its meaning in society was just too strong. Bhante in his seminars also wonders if The Buddha is actually recalling a much more ancient notion of the Brahmin that was much, much earlier, where the Brahmin was the sort of shaman of the tribe, the shaman. I mean, it lost that meaning. But some people believe that originally the Brahmin was the shaman of the tribe, the individual who would go out into the forest to discover special knowledge, the knowledge that the tribe, the community needed for its survival. And so the Buddha could be using that notion to describe the enlightened individual, the man, the individual who goes off, leaves society, goes off away, who discovers enlightenment in the depths of the forest, profoundly alone, completely away from the group. And we can see what the spiritual qualities of such a man might be in the verse. So when things become manifest, there's other ways you can translate that. Something like, when the truth of things becomes clearly visible. When the truth of things becomes clearly visible, or when the truth of things opens up to the ardent. Ardent is a translation of the Pali tapas, which means making heat, making fire. So it's more like burning, blazing. Tapas is a very ancient term for the spiritual life. Very, very old term, non-technical term, which the Buddha employs. So tapas means making heat, generating energy. Meditation, spiritual practice, is about making yourself hot so that you start melting the fetters, melting those manacles. We make ourselves hot through spiritual practice. And then Ireland's word meditating refers to jhana, someone in the depths of the profoundest meditation. So such a man like this, who is blazing and in the depths of meditation, he abides always. He's constantly routing, scattering Mara's hosts, the Mara Sena, Mara's army, Mara's forces. Mara and his army are, of course, the personification of the whole of conditioned existence. Yeah, Mara's a very old term. Mara can mean death, in the literal sense of, if you like, the realm of birth and death, but also death in the sense of the death of higher values, the death of spiritual life, because that's what Mara does. He kind of kills off your spiritual life. So Mara, in all these senses, whether it's birth and death, the wheel of life, or whether it's spiritual death in the sense of the death of you as a spiritual practitioner, all that scattered, routed, broken up through this man who sees things as they are, who blazes with spiritual energy and who meditates deeply. He really is like the sun lighting up the sky, the whole of space. In the seminar, very interesting, Bhante says a verse like this, where you get this image of the enlightened man being like the sun lighting up the whole of space, Bhante feels that it anticipates the later image of Vairochanar, the illuminator, the great sun Buddha who is at the centre of the mandala, whose light reveals the whole of reality. It's very interesting. Bhante sees the seed of a development like that right there in the oldest traditions of the Pali Canon. So let's end our study this morning with an alternative translation of this udana. Let's try and put into English as much meaning as we can. And this will sort of sum up our studies this morning. And then after this, we'll go in silence and have a cup of tea, silence until the end of lunch, and just use this silent time to really contemplate, matters to do with the udana. Really, and what I would suggest when you contemplate, just follow your interest. You know, if there's been any particular thing that's really got you this morning, well, just stay with that. Just go right into that. Follow your interest. Then, on realizing the significance of conditioned co-production, the richly endowed one breathed forth on that occasion this inspired utterance. When the truth of things opens up to the blazing, meditating shaman, he abides, scattering Mara's army like the sun illuminating the sky.